What's up, gang? Thanks for joining the Undiplomatic Podcast, the show with undiplomatic takes about the foreign policy scene. I'm your host, Van Jackson, and we got a bunch of shit going on. I hope you guys are doing all right. Before we get going, I wanted to check in about where we are with the military occupation of DC. Pretty fucking ridiculous. This is what we've got the military doing. Picking up trash, bro. Picking up trash. So on one level, I'd rather have the military cleaning up the city, literally picking up trash, than doing fucking quote unquote lethality. But I would say it's probably best to not waste the time and money in the first place on any of this, right? Very expensive trash picker uppers. So actually, one of my people, Hannah Homestead, she wrote about the abuse, the violence, the waste of militarily occupying DC, aside from any terror or exercise of control over a democratic city that Trump is trying to achieve with this. She writes, quote, "The price tag of deploying 2,091 troops to DC, which is a lot of fucking troops, is well over $1 million per day. And the number of troops will likely continue to grow with no deadline for the DC deployment. Those costs could add up for months or even years." She goes on to say, "This militarized spending comes at the expense of federal programs like public housing that actually do prevent crime." There are studies about this, by the way, "and improve health and education outcomes. The moral violation and the tyranny of a military deployment on American soil is so fucking egregious. But what shouldn't be lost is that on just pure public policy terms, like if you actually had a good faith belief that you needed to get crime under control, which is a bullshit argument, but let's go with that. If that's what your actual goal is, you could do it at one quarter of the price of deploying the military. This is nuts. Like Hannah says, if the Guard remains deployed for 3 months, it would cost more than operating public housing for the entire unhoused population in DC for an entire year. Show me your budget and I'll show you what you value." That's what this kind of situation is, right? We don't value actual solutions to crime. We value the act of domination and repression in response to crime. We value that kind of muscle flex of power. We value doing violence against others. And like we said, the last time I had Julia and Matt on the show, we talked about how in this kind of capitalist system, even though the cost of remedying homelessness is quite small, you can't actually allow it to happen. And this is where the repression and the violence of the security state gets tied up with oligarchy, gets tied up with a system of wealth preservation, wealth hoarding, wealth redistribution that needs to be enforced by the security state. And it's better to do that, even if it's expensive, than to depress the value of homes by housing everybody and diluting the value of homes. So this economic system where the only wealth that a normal person can hope to have is in their house and in the value of that house going up, well, that's a system that is going, whose preservation is not cost-free. It costs, the expense of it, the hidden cost of it, is the homeless guy on the corner. It is this enduring problem of homelessness in our cities. And like, I seen Joaquin Castro and some, good Democrats going in public and calling all of this fascist bullshit out. It's tyranny. It is a war on democratic cities. It's a war on the Democratic Party, which is something we're going to talk about in the next segment, I think. But basically, like, what is to be done here? I mean, direct action, civil disobedience. I feel like I'm a broken record on this, but that's where we are. And I don't just mean by professional activists or people who are very politically active. Like, we're at a stage where we need celebrities and influencers, people who are not even thought of as like especially political normally, but who have big public profiles, right? They need to put their bodies out there, risking arrest, risking harm, And because if they do that, A, they can make the state choose to be repressive, which is what they've already chosen, right? And B, get that shit on camera so that everybody realizes that nobody is safe. Celebrity is like the most protected class in this, in fucking America, but even they're not safe if they do the wrong thing. Even they're not safe if they speak out on behalf of Gaza, or if they oppose the deployment of National Guard or secret police, right? If they interfere in illegal arrests of brown folks, they're going to get caught up too. And everyone needs to know that and see that. And that's the stage that we are at in this shit. Right. So on the theme of Trump as waging war against the Democrats, which is not even metaphorical when you're deploying, you know, troops to Democratic cities, that's a little too on the nose. But the latest salvo in this siege against the Democrats is Trump going after George Soros, Alex Soros, the Open Society Foundation, and all of their activities. So Trump says George Soros and his wonderful radical left son should be charged with RICO because of their support of violent protests and much more all throughout the United States of America. We're not going to allow these lunatics to rip apart America anymore, never giving it as so much as a chance to breathe, quote unquote, and be free. Soros and his group of psychopaths have caused great damage to our country. That includes his crazy West Coast friends. Be careful. We're watching you. Thank you for your attention on this matter. So, I mean, a RICO charge, that's serious. That's what you charge the mafia with. That's one step away from declaring them terrorists, right? So this is like super fuck. And I should say, for people who don't know, the Soroses are the biggest or one of the biggest donors to the Democratic Party. They have this great philanthropic cause, which is the Open Society Foundation, where they're supporting pro-democracy NGOs around the world. And this has made them the enemy of far-right conspiracy theorists. And the far right globally has always treated George Soros, billionaire hedge fund guy originally, right? Always treated him as the avatar for anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, right? This is like very famous. There's so much you could read about this online if you wanted to. But you have to take that into account because like it's George Soros who is the image that comes to mind for fascists. When people like Marjorie Taylor Greene talk about like Jewish space lasers, they're talking about George Soros-led conspiracies. And anytime that the far right mentions Soros, the name Soros, it's always dog-whistling anti-Semitism, like always. And here, that anti-Semitism is being dressed up a little bit, right? Because, I mean, his son is not radical left. I wish Alex Soros was radical left, you know? He's a liberal, you know? He's maybe a progressive, but he's a liberal. Like, he's friends with the Clintons, you know? By going after the Soroses, not only is Trump doing the anti-Semitic dog whistle, which appeals to the white supremacists, which appeals to the real true believing fascists in his base, but he's doing it as a way to attack his enemies. Use the state to punish your enemies, you know? And the grounds for this, the pretext, is should be fucking terrifying to everybody. Like, why does anybody think that they are safe just because they're quiet? Why do you think that will save you? If you stand for anything less than fascism, they're going to go after you. They're probably going to go after their own too at some point, you know? But like, look at, read the thing, right? The Soroses support violent protests throughout the United States. The protests across the United States have not been violent. It's the police and ICE who have been violent. The protests have not been violent. And even if they were, The protests are not being funded by the Open Society Foundation. They're not being funded by the Soroses. Jewish space lasers, except with like real life consequences. That's what this shit is appealing to, right? So this is the latest, you know, step in this larger war. The FBI raid of John Bolton, which I think we talked about in the last episode. Since the last episode, Trump fired the Fed governor, which the president doesn't have the authority to do. So again, openly illegal, right? But also like the revoking, well, we talked about this on the last episode too, the revoking of 37 security clearances from, you know, national security technocrats who had ties to the Democratic Party, basically. It's using state power to punish your enemies and to sometimes reward your friends. It's pure Schmidtian shit, and it's totally fascist, and it's what we're dealing with, and you're not safe from it just because you're fucking ignorant about it, you know? I'm sure that a billionaire who's networked into polite society in New York and has donated tons to politicians over the years and is friends with tons of politicians over the years, I'm sure that he probably thought he was safe from being, having the state directed at him, having the DOJ directed at him. And yet here we are, right? Ain't nobody safe. This is insane, but also not surprising. Okay, this is about U.S. malign foreign influence in Greenland, in Denmark. The Danish foreign minister summoned the head of mission for the U.S. in Copenhagen and, I mean, rebuked him, chided him, you know, basically told him off in, you know, very diplomatic ways that are not really going to matter probably. But it's because at least three people with connections to Donald Trump have been carrying out covert influence operations in Greenland. This is the government of Denmark making this accusation, and they say that the reason is to try and weaken ties between Denmark and Greenland, to try and foment a kind of rebellion or autonomous movement, try to astroturf it, basically. First of all, this is what the CIA did since its founding in the Cold War. This is what America has always done, like always. When the intelligence community is not killing people, it's trying to overthrow various governments abroad, oftentimes even democratic ones. The case of Denmark and Greenland is fucking weird because Denmark's a democracy and Greenland's a fucking colony. But be that as it may, what we're doing, what the U.S. is doing, these covert influence operations, this is, first of all, exactly what the U.S. national security bros accuse China of doing all the time. All the time. This is what they're so paranoid about. And we have this habit, I feel like people don't notice this, but like the China hawks in America and in the West, they characterize China as everything that they aspire to be. Like the way that they see China is demented. They see China as malign and evil and like bent on conquest and all this stuff. Very zero sum. That's how they act. They project onto China what they are and what they wish to be. What they say about China and how the West characterizes China has very little to do with the nature of China or what China's actually up to. And this ain't, I'm not giving China a pass. Like, I know China engages in foreign influence operations also, you know, but the point is that you shouldn't feel too scandalized about that when A, you choose to be in a fucking zero-sum existential rivalry with them. That was your choice, you know. You don't have to, it doesn't have to be this way. But B, like at the beginning of the Trump administration, I debated whether to frame this story as being about Denmark or being about Trumperialism, because at the beginning of the administration, I published several pieces, and I think I even talked about it on some episodes, about the imperialist embrace the imperialist character of U.S. foreign policy under Trump. And that's not to say that American foreign policy wasn't imperialist before, but now it's very on the nose. It's very much in a way where it's like the model of an imperialist foreign policy is what we should be using to predict Trump's foreign policy. You know, I don't want to go off on a tangent, but like we saw, like Lee Jae-myung, South Korea's president, just had a summit with Trump. And Trump was saying in the summit that like what the U.S. should get or want in exchange for maintaining the U.S. Alliance with South Korea and maintaining troops in South Korea, which is not a gift, by the way, but like if that's how you want to view it, what Trump wants in return for that continued military occupation of an ally is to own the land in Seoul where Yongsan Garrison is. Like if you haven't been to South Korea, Yongsan is like a huge piece of land in the heart of Seoul, the capital. It's one of the most expensive areas for real estate in the world. And like everywhere, we lease the land where we put our bases. We don't own that land. South Korea wouldn't let us own that land. The whole reason we're there is to preserve South Korean ownership of its own land against others. That is like the whole premise behind the fucking alliance, you know? And so Trump wants to undermine that or subvert that. And like people chalk it up to like, oh, it's just a bargaining tactic within the alliance or something. No, he wants the fucking land. He wants the land, and he's going to use the troop presence as the bargaining chip. He's going to threaten to remove troops if he doesn't get the land. And this is some of the most expensive territory in the world. Okay, so South Korea ain't going to fucking give it to us. But it's the same with Greenland. We're trying to get the land, right? It's the same with the feckless claim about trying to own Canada, which is like not really going to go anywhere. But like the underlying motivation is the land, right? The same with the Panama Canal, you know? Everywhere, anywhere and everywhere. The whole orientation with Ukraine and the Trump administration about continuing to provide missiles, it's not about the war with Russia for them. It's about the critical minerals in Ukraine, which there is some sort of sketched out deal of it for like large scale, industrial scale extraction of Ukrainian wealth, Ukrainian resources. Again, it's like all territory, you know, it's all territory. It's all natural resource extraction. That's the paradigm for these fucking guys. You know, Gaza itself, you need ethnic cleansing so that you can do development projects in Gaza. They've fucking laid this out. The master key of Trump foreign policy is really about territorial acquisition and resource extraction. And that's why we end up doing what, when China does this, we call it gray zone activity, foreign malign influence. That's precisely what it is now. The difference is we are in a rivalry with China. So if China does gray zone activity, that is a symptom of rivalry. That is evidence of a rivalry. And so it's inherent. If you have a geopolitical rivalry, gray zone activity, covert operations and shit is inherent. It is evidence of rivalry, right? We don't have a rivalry with Denmark, or I mean, maybe we do now, but we don't have geopolitical competition with Denmark that then justifies or rationalizes covert operations and gray zone activities. So we're doing the thing that we accuse China of doing, but we're doing it without any kind of, you know, justification or rationale or pretext other than that we want their fucking land. That makes us evil. Once again, what is the national security state doing? All right, next story, MAGA's China contradiction. This is kind of bananas. I'm going to try to keep this narrow because I talk about China stuff a lot on the show. But Trump had a bombshell that like exploded the brains of the like national security bros and of MAGA, right? About China. And so he's been talking to Xi Jinping. There is diplomacy between China and the US, and there's talk about Trump maybe going to China. In that context, Trump had this to say.
President Xi would like me to come to China. It's a very important relationship. As you know, we're taking a lot of money in from China because of the tariffs and the different things. And it's a very important relationship. We're going to get along good with China. I hear so many stories about we're not going to allow their students. We're going to allow their students to come in. We're going to allow, it's very important, 600,000 students. It's very important. But we're going to get along with China.
600,000 students. So first of all, that's a lot of students. That there's, as of last year, I have the number here. China sent 277,000 students to the U.S. in 2023 and 2024. That's a shitload. That number is getting like way depressed now because Trump has made it super fucking hard to study in America as a foreigner. They've cut the visas. They're imposing restrictions and surveillance on foreign students, especially Chinese students. America's greatest export to the world is higher education, is its university system. And that export comes in the form of foreign students who come to America and study. I feel like everybody knows this, or most people know this, right? They don't always think of it in those terms, but it's true. Like, this is America's greatest export to the world. So the context for this is that Trump is trying to play nice with China. He's trying to have a kind of detente with China, friendly relations with Xi Jinping. And this is kind of fascinating. I want to like probe that more in a second. The problem or the limitation is that his own base is fucking disgusted by this, predictably, right? The idea that these fucking like rabid racist warmongers within the far right, the idea that they would be like okay with 600,000 Chinese students in the country is obviously doesn't pass the laugh test, right? So here's Howard Lutnick kind of explaining why he thinks this needs to happen, or why he's like, he's, you know, justifying Trump's statement.
Mr. Secretary, with all due respect, how is allowing 600,000 students from the communist country of China putting America first?
Well, the president's...
So there's some like revealing shit in that, right? On the one hand, you see the Fox, you know, Laura Ingraham disgust at the idea of Chinese students. And she's like wanting a rationale. And Howard Lutnick, he speaks to the rationale, right? There's a basic truth that Howard Lutnick is giving voice to here, which is that America's higher education system does actually collapse without foreign students. That's just totally true. And so since China sends more students than fucking anybody, They're the center of gravity for that problem. If you ban Chinese students, you wither away American higher ed, which again is cutting off America's greatest export to the world. The bad faith element here is that like the Trump administration doesn't necessarily care. Like they're going to war against the American university system. They're defunding American university research all over the place. They're imposing restrictions on universities. They're making it, they've been making it harder for Chinese students to study in America. So Trump says this. He says this thing about doubling the number of Chinese students in America, but he's actually acting, or like the administration is actively acting in the opposite way. They're actively making it harder for Chinese students to study in America. They're chasing away Chinese students and all foreign students. You know, I teach at a university. I talk to students all the time. Nobody wants to study in America right now. They know that they're taking their like lives and careers in their hands, or they're losing that, putting that at risk if they go study in America. And so the Trump administration doesn't care about the American university system and its health and its robustness. They don't. They want to control it. And part of controlling it requires weakening it and destroying it and largely defunding it. So this is not primarily about the economic reality that we are beholden to China. We are economically interdependent with China in multiple ways, one of them being reliant on their student population to come study and pay full foreign freight on that tuition. But also, like, this is really about Trump trying to get on with China and wanting to create a source of leverage in the event that negotiations with China go south. You need to it's like with the NVIDIA thing. You know, the Biden administration wants to impose export controls. It wants to limit technology sharing with China. It wants to cut them off. And that's a self-defeating proposition, which we've found out for a number of reasons, not least that it's triggered Chinese indigenous technology innovation that surpasses the US, which is a fucking problem. But also China has control over all of the like critical minerals that we need to do our thing, you know? So like separating from all that, that was the Biden approach, you know, withhold. Withhold doesn't give you leverage. Trump wants leverage. So you need to be able to release NVIDIA chips out into the wilderness of China. You know what I mean? It's too late. It's not like working, but that's the logic. Create leverage. You know what I mean? Because then you can exploit it. In the NVIDIA case, you can exploit it by like putting in a backdoor or malware or something that like the US can then exploit. But you can also exploit the leverage if it's like effectively holding Chinese students hostage. 600,000 Chinese students in America, hostages. State power can be turned against them at any moment, just like it currently is against them. And that is something that Trump can then use in negotiations with China. So as long as things are good with China, stuff like this 600,000 students can happen. But the second China takes a hard line or Trump's negotiations fail for some reason, then suddenly all falls apart. And Trump would need leverage at that point. The students is the leverage. That's what's really going on here. But that's not sellable to the MAGA base, right? So you've got Laura Loomer. She's been going crazy about, like, her mind's exploding, right? She goes, she keeps calling them all Chinese spies, right? Nobody, I repeat, nobody wants 600,000 more Chinese students, aka communist spies, in the United States. China murdered 1.2 million Americans. Now they get to replace us? This cannot happen. Okay, so first of all, obviously that's very white supremacist. It's dog whistling, they shall not replace us, the Charlottesville white, literal white supremacy fucking march, right? But also 1.2 million Americans, that's a reference to the China COVID conspiracy theory, right? So layers and layers of racist hate here, right? Also the subversion accusation going after people in America who look fucking Chinese as spies, right? Unbelievable, unbelievable, but also very predictable, very predictable. This is fucking Laura Loomer at her best. You know what I mean? Where does this leave us, right? The MAGA base is pissed, will not accept this, which means that Trump will be able to easily kick out all the Chinese students anytime he wants if Sino-US relations end up in the shitter. I've been thinking about this a lot. Like, you know, the phrase only Nixon can go to China, that's not real. Like, the truth of that history was that Democratic opposition during the Nixon years were in a race with Nixon to engage China, to open China in effect. And Nixon was trying to beat the Democrats or preempt the Democrats. So it's not true that only Nixon could go to China, but the logic of that phrase applies here, right? Only Trump can overcome great power competition. He can't end it because it's structural. America's economy is beholden to, you know, military industrial interests. The whole national security state, on which we spend close to $2 trillion a year. $2 trillion a year. When you add up the military shit and the national security and the intelligence, border enforcement, all of it. $2 trillion a year for the national security state. That entire apparatus is predicated on great power competition. War with China. If you strip out, if you remove the China enemy from the national security state's mission set, if you say, guess what, we're friends now, reprogram yourself. 70% of what we spend on national security would have to go away. you know, or I mean, we'd probably find new enemies, but like most of what we spend of our $2 trillion hangs on the notion, the preparation for great war with fucking China. And that is not something that you can overcome because you've had a summit, because you get along with Xi Jinping, because you're engaged in two-way trade and investment still, because you let in some of their students or vice versa, right? The forces of great power rivalry are structural. They are downstream of a crisis of capital accumulation. You can read the book Over My Shoulder, The Rivalry Peril, if you want to know more about that, right? There, it's true that like the consensus around great power competition and China as enemy, as racist as that is, by consensus, I mean like Democrats and Republicans, everybody in fucking Washington, that consensus can only be punctured by somebody like Trump. And it sucks that we have to rely on him to be the voice of reason, but it is that this is where we are, a sign of the times. You know, we're depending on the whims of this literal tyrant to make reasoned choices in relation to our crackpot fucking realism of the war hawks. Okay, for the last segment today, I really wish my co-host Julia Gledhill was here for this one. Taking the profits out of war. So Julia, she actually has a piece in Responsible Statecraft, which is very good. It's called "Is Nationalizing the Defense Industry Such a Bad Idea?" Next episode, we get her, when we get the crew back, we'll probably talk about this again in greater depth. But I didn't want to let the moment slip, because this is in the idea of nationalizing the defense industry is on the table now in a way that it has not been in my entire lifetime. But if you go back, not just to the 60s, to the fucking 1910s, I'm talking like World War I era, the idea of where war comes from, it was always tied to the idea of the profit motive. Taking the profits out of war was a super popular slogan. Smedley Butler wrote a little pamphlet book, Marine General, called War is a Racket, right? It was all about taking the profits out of war. Woody Guthrie, what did he say? War is a game played by maniacs who kill each other. Locate the man who profits by war and strip him of his profits. War will end, right? This is like, this used to be, I'm saying this because it used to be conventional wisdom. And in the era of like, you know, neoliberal globalization, the veneration of the market, that idea became anathema, just like industrial policy became anathema, right? And now we're, of course, in a different world. Actually, Bill Hartung, who's another, you know, friend of the pod, he had a piece that just came out separate from Julia's piece. And together, they're like covering the full territory of this issue, because Julia is basically making a case that like we should be nationalizing the defense industry, right? If it's supposed to be a public good, it's the basic thing that a national security state exists to do. Why should it be driven by profits, right? And we do have a huge corruption and lobbying problem, right? The defense industry base is the reason why we spend so much on the military and on national security, which in turn is why we have this over-militarized foreign policy, right? Take the profits out of war. Bill Hartung's piece points out, and I mean, Julia is good on this too, but Bill is like, we don't necessarily need to nationalize Lockheed Martin, right? Because it's not going to solve any of the problems that we have. And what they're both converging on is that like how you do this matters a lot. You know, if an oligarchic administration that is just using state power to enrich itself, to reward its friends, to punish its enemies, which is clearly what's going on, nationalization is a way of increasing state power. That's not good. That's not what we want. That's not going to discipline the market. It's not going to discipline defense spending, right? So we don't get anything out of nationalization per se because it's the Trump administration. But there is a larger case to be made for nationalization, for taking a directing ownership share of companies like Lockheed and Northrop Grumman. And yes, Palantir, right? I mean, abolish Palantir. But like these companies should be under government control and people shouldn't be making a buck off of them because they are the proliferators of war, right? So this is all being triggered because the Trump administration is looking at buying or getting ownership of Lockheed Martin. And they've done this with other companies in the tech sector recently. So this is Howard Lutnick kind of making sense of that, to the chagrin of Andrew Ross Sorkin, who's like, mind is exploding and is going to cry in his Wall Street oatmeal.
What about defense companies, though, Secretary? Why shouldn't the U.S. government say, you know what, we use Palantir services, we would like a piece of Palantir. We use Boeing services, we would like a piece of Boeing. There are a lot of businesses that do business with the U.S. government that benefit by doing business with the U.S. government. Where's the line?
Oh, there's a monstrous discussion about defense. I mean, Lockheed Martin makes 97% of their revenue from the U.S. government. They are basically an arm of the U.S. government. They make exquisite.
That's true.
There's a lot of talking that needs to be had about how do we finance our munitions acquisitions. I think a lot of that is talking, and now you have the right people in the jobs and Donald Trump at the head thinking about what is the right way to do it. I tell you, the way it has been done has been a giveaway.
So once again, the most evil version of the thing that's right, you know, this solves no problems that we have with the defense industry in practice, in reality, because it's just taking an ownership share, but then letting everything just go on as it was before, right? But in theory, this is like solving what a lot of people think is the root cause of war, which is the profit motive in national defense. The opportunity in this, like so much with the Trump administration, is that we don't want to counter-program ourselves against Trump and oppose this stuff simply because it's Trump doing it. There's an alternative future where taking government stakes, taking a government share of a private company who produces things like weapons or, you know, semiconductors or something, that's owning the means of production. That's the definition of socialism. That as a direction or a valence, like that's the place that we want to move toward, right? But you can do that stupidly and you can do that intelligently. You know, the Soviet Union itself did that stupidly, right? And so we don't want to do it in the most like craven fucking evil way, but we do kind of want to do that. And in a previous era where everyone's got like, you know, liberal market brain, when globalization dominates common sense, it's impossible to move in the direction of socialism. Now, it's actually quite reasonable, and it's doing it as the not evil version, doing it as the good version where it's anchored in the common good and a public accountability and having democracy as like a means and an end. Well, that's the ultimate promise. So Trump is doing things with state power that is like setting precedents that social democrats and progressives can use in, I mean, I would say in the future after an election. I don't know if we're going to have elections. We'll see. But assuming that good guys can ever take power, Trump is setting precedents that we can use. He's breaking the China, if you will. He's puncturing taboos, and that is kind of like the silver lining in all of this dystopian fascist shit. So maybe that's a unusual, unconventional source of optimism from the Undiplomatic Podcast, which is to say, like, dialectical thinking, you know? All right, well, I hope everybody's taking care of themselves. Like and subscribe, I guess, please, you know? And I'll catch you real soon. All right, peace.